You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange. Thanks for joining us. The JX starts today with the debrief, where JPR reporters discuss the stories they've been covering this week, including a split vote in the Ashland City Council over a ballot question, Grants Pass reassigns a homelessness grant, and why the Jackson County District Attorney is taking the Oregon Department of Corrections to court. I'm Maria Carter, JPR's news director.
I'm Justin Higginbottom, public health and safety reporter.
And I'm Jane Vaughn, housing, homelessness, and education reporter.
And our reporter, Roman Battaglia, is off today, but here's our conversation from yesterday about a ballot measure in Ashland. Hey there, Roman.
Hi, Maria.
You brought us a story this week from the Ashland City Council about a proposed citizen initiative. What does this initiative exactly propose?
So it would require voters, if voters approved it, it would require voters to approve any increases to utility fees in the city. So, voters already have to approve things like levies and taxes, but not for extra fees on your utility bill. So Ashland, runs its own water and sewage supply. They also have an electricity company, and they even run internet services. So sometimes they put these fees on utility bills to charge for different city services like public safety and such. So this is common in other cities, not just Ashland. Like I know in Corvallis, they charge a utility fee for around $3 to $4, which means all the buses in the city are free. So, there's different ways that they use utility fees. So this petition was introduced earlier this year by a resident of Ashland, George Kramer. He's kind of been active in speaking at city council meetings for a long time, and he's also tried and failed to run for mayor and city council in the past.
So why is George Kramer bringing this forward as a ballot measure?
It mostly has to do with the city, raising these utility fees without voter input. They've recently raised these fees multiple times this year. So they raised the public safety fee from $1.50 to $5 a month, which funds their ambulance service. They raised this wildfire risk reduction fee from $3 to $7 a month, which funds wildfire mitigation and emergency management stuff. And then they also added a $5 a month parks fee to keep those funded as well. So, and then these also come with inflation adjustments, which means they're going to increase every year with inflation. So, Kramer is kind of concerned about voters not having enough say in this process. They can vote on taxes, but they don't get a say in these fees that the city council can just approve, which are basically the same thing as taxes, because you can't not pay for water in the city if you want to get water. So he wants voters basically just to have the ability to propose or to vote on any of these proposed utility fee increases in the future.
Well, why did the Ashland City Council consider this measure?
So, he brought it forward as this citizen's petition, meaning that, normally you need to get enough signatures to get it on the ballot. But the city council can also choose to take up those petitions and just put it on the ballot themselves. Sometimes the city council just makes their own ballot initiatives and puts it up. So they could have just taken it, and that's what happened. So Councilor Gina Duquesne proposed it because she thought that this might be important or people might want a voice, and that means that Kramer wouldn't have to get those signatures and it would just go straight to the ballot.
So what went down at the meeting?
So, some people supported it and some people were against it. And the people who were supporting putting this on the ballot were partially doing it to kind of get ahead of it. One of the counselors, Dylan Bloom, which I have in the story, said that he would campaign against this measure if it was on the ballot. But he wanted to make sure that the city got ahead of it in terms of preventing misinformation about the ballot measure. There's been concern from some council members about, misinformation in recent city elections. Some, claiming that George Kramer has been spreading some of this misinformation around recent tax measures that have failed. So, they're kind of concerned about that and want to try to get ahead of it. Some of the other council members, who are against this proposal just thought it wouldn't be good for the city. They would say, it would tie the council's hands. It would leave them with less flexibility to change, adapt to their situation. And then they also just don't think that Kramer has the city's best interests in mind. So the city council tied 3-3 on the vote.
Uh-oh.
And that means that the mayor, Tanya Graham, who normally doesn't vote, had to break the tie. So she voted to reject this petition. She said that she'd rather, instead of supporting this, support a rigorous public engagement plan for utility fee increases. And that is something that the council agreed they'll start discussing soon.
So what happens next?
So now that the council decided not to put on the ballot themselves, that means that George Kramer will instead have to get those signatures. He's already been gathering those. He needs to gather 1,308 signatures exactly, which is 15% of the amount of people that voted in the most recent mayoral election. He says he has around 400 to 500 now and has a goal of around 1,500 because, you know, some of those signatures will be invalidated.
It always happens.
Yeah, exactly. But he has a lot of time to gather signatures. In Oregon, most citizens' petitions give you 2 years from when it's approved by the clerk to get the signatures. And he got it approved in the summer, so he still has around a year and a half left. Though he has said he's trying to get it on the May primary or the November general election next year. So we'll see. You know, some of the counselors during the meeting said they thought it's pretty likely he'll get enough signatures, and that's kind of why they wanted to approve it, so that they can, you know, kind of get behind it, or, you know, not get behind it and support it, but kind of get in front of it and, you know, lead the messaging on it.
Okay. Well, thank you, Roman.
Yeah, you're welcome.
That was Roman Battaglia. Jane, you brought us an update this week about a grant to address homelessness in Grants Pass. What's going on there? What's the latest?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, this is something I've covered a lot, you know, talk about Grants Pass homelessness quite a bit. And so I watched their city council meeting on Monday, and they're working on giving out a $1.2 million grant to address homelessness there, which has been sort of a long process. And a couple weeks ago, they picked a group called Pathways to Stability to give them the grant, except for Pathways wanted to use a piece of property for their program that was owned by the county, and they were given a time period in order to sort of secure that property, and they weren't able to get the land so that they could actually use it for the program. And so on Monday, the Grants Pass City Council rescinded the grant from Pathways, and instead they gave it to a different group, a developer called Elk Island Trading Group, who's from Roseburg, and they run three homeless tent camps there. But there's still the same sort of contingency. Elk Island also has to secure the piece of property that it wants to use. They've picked a different piece of property. It's owned by Bi-Mart. And so it's sort of to be determined that the grant isn't totally finalized yet, but they've got to work on now getting the piece of property that they want to use for their program.
So give us some background here. Why does Grants Pass need this grant?
I mean, there are a lot of reasons. As we've discussed, Grants Pass has an increasingly visible homelessness problem, like a lot of places do. The city's been sued a few times in recent years, two times, over its treatment of their homeless residents. The most recent lawsuit was dismissed in August after the city agreed to provide space for 150 homeless people within the city's urban growth boundary for 1 year. And that site also has to be low barrier and comply with the Americans with Disabilities Act. And so that's what they're trying to do with this grant, is they're going to give $1.2 million to an entity that they choose. And the goal is to have them provide space for 150 homeless people. And the city also currently has several unmanaged homeless camps downtown. There are a few of them within basically two blocks, so they're pretty concentrated. And so opening this new program would allow the city to close down those unmanaged sites downtown, and instead they'd have this managed site wherever that location ends up being. And so that's sort of the broader goal, especially for the people who are currently living near the unmanaged camps. They want those to close down and have a managed camp open somewhere.
So what happens next?
It all sort of depends on whether or not Elk Island can get the land that it wants to use, and they really need to do so pretty quickly because the Grants Pass City Council is going to consider the proposed grant agreement on November 19th, and then there's a week of what's called a protest period, so the execution of the final grant agreement is on December 1st. So they need to have a draft grant agreement and provide verification of the property or a letter of intent or something by November 10th, which is Monday. So Elk Island basically was given a week to get some sort of letter of intent or
verification.
These
are tight timelines.
Really a tight timeline to prove that they can use this land and get this land. And then the program would need to be operational by June 1st. There's 6 months from there. And it was interesting because the counselors really clashed a lot over this at their Monday meeting. They were accusing each other of bias in how they were scoring the applicants, you know, that they wanted one applicant over another. They kind of went back and forth. It was a split vote to give Elk Island the grant. It wasn't unanimous. And then Elk Island as an entity itself is also really interesting. On an unrelated note, I had published a big feature about their homeless camps in Roseburg this week. But if Elk Island then can't secure their land, I don't really know what would happen next. I mean, the city has a couple of options, but they'd kind of be back to the drawing board. I don't know if they would give the grant to their third-ranked applicant now, which is the only one left, or they could issue another RFP for the grant, which would be the third time they've done that. So they really have to figure that out. But it depends if Elk Island can get the land first.
And they've got a timeline too, right?
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Well, Justin, you reported on the Jackson County District Attorney taking the Oregon Department of Corrections to court. What's that about?
Yeah, so the Jackson County DA filed a contempt of court action against the state corrections department this week, as well as that department's director and that department's sentence computational administrator, which will make more sense as I explain what this complaint's about. But it's over basically the agency's recalculating the prison sentences of hundreds of inmates in the state, but that includes quite a number in Jackson County as well. And this recalculation led to a man named Joaquin Coward being released 4 years early. So he was serving a 12-year sentence for repeated child sexual abuse, and he was one of a few in Jackson County and quite a number across the state who were released early because of this recalculation. In a previous letter, the DA, the Jackson County DA, sent to the department, the corrections department, that DA mentioned two other inmates released in Jackson County early, including one convicted of a DUI, which injured infants in a crash, and another person convicted of sexual assault of a minor. So the Jackson County DA has an issue with these prisoners being let out early.
Well, let's back it up a little bit. Why did the Department of Corrections recalculate the sentences?
It all has to do with a recent Oregon Supreme Court case, and basically that case expanded, that ruling expanded the opportunity for inmates to receive credit for time served. So it allows that time served to, say, in pretrial detention to apply to unrelated charges the person might be already in jail for or probation violations. It's kind of complicated, the decision, if you're not well-versed in it like I am. But after this decision, the DOC basically had to go over thousands of prisoner sentences and recalculate them. In Joaquin Coward's case, the guy in Jackson County who got out 4 years early, DOC, what they did was apply his time served to each consecutive sentence he received. So Coward was convicted of four charges for each of his victims, and each count in that case, and the judge had wanted those charges to run consecutively, one after another, so 12 years in prison. The DOC went back and applied his time served credit to each one of those sentences, each one of those charges. So they quadrupled, effectively, his time served. And Jackson County is arguing that this is not what the judge wanted when he sentenced Coward. He obviously wanted him to be in jail quite a bit longer, and that's where you get the contempt of court.
So this contempt of court action is about getting Coward back in jail?
Right. And there's also a fine, actually, for the Department of Corrections for every day Coward remains out of jail and the department is in contempt. Something else.
That's if the judge rules in favor of the Jackson County DA?
Yeah, exactly. So, and something else the DA had an issue with is that Coward's victims, his office, you know, the prosecutor in that case, had no idea Coward was being released. So the victim's family actually got word like the day of Coward's release, and they're the ones who contacted the DA and say, you know, what's up with that? And so, you know, this is potentially happening around the state. There'll be a hearing in December here in Jackson County, and we'll be covering that.
Okay, well, thank you, Justin. You also had a story about a final judgment in a lawsuit by the Curry County Board of Commissioners against that county sheriff. What was decided there?
So the judge ruled the commissioners can't use a local ordinance to force Sheriff John Ward to turn over all documents that they might request. Commissioners had sued Ward in January seeking a court order to make him comply with an ordinance they passed last year that was actually directed at his office, and which basically Ward ignored. Most of the sections actually were determined to be legal by a judge, like the requirement that Ward turn over personal records and duplicate keys to county vehicles, although the court ruled the board can't compel Ward to attend county meetings under the law. And this last section of the ordinance requiring Ward to hand over any records requested by the board, that led to a trial, which the judge decided on this week.
And why does the sheriff have a problem giving over these documents?
He argued his office has some documents with restricted access. Only other law enforcement can see those. And the judge basically agreed with him. But importantly, in his opinion, the judge said a similar ordinance was probably necessary in the county. He said it's clear to the court, at least, that the sheriff has not provided a number of documents requested by county council related to matters of county concern. And that, you know, there should be an ordinance there, but reworked in that the sheriff can talk with county council about the restricted access and reasons for that upon the board's request.
So there might be some law enforcement things that's only for law enforcement, but other documents should be shared with the council.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, well, thank you, Justin. That's it for the debrief this week. Thanks for listening. You can reach the newsroom with comments on our coverage and suggestions for things we should cover in the future through our news tip line. That's on our website, ijpr.org. And you can find this program and more at jeffexchange.org or on your favorite podcast platform.